So good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out on another beautiful summer evening. Most of you probably know, but maybe some of you don't, that this is the third night of a four-night series we call a Dharma seminar on practicing with anger. Practicing with anger in angry times is what I gave as a title. So did you know you were coming out to talk about anger on a hot summer evening? Let's just imagine a cool breeze or a cool towel laid over our brow. Feel nice and cool as we think about anger. The first week we talked about the energy of anger, which is, you know, a fiery anger with the potential to do so much harm. We talked about what anger is in terms of neurobiology and in terms of Buddhist thought. And then the second night we talked about how we practice with anger through awareness of body, mind, and heart, through wisdom and compassion. And tonight, I want to turn to a question that often arises when we talk about practicing with anger. And that is, what about righteous anger? What about anger in the face of cruelty and injustice in our world? Moral outrage. Can anger be a positive force? Can it fuel compassionate action? Often people ask these questions or wonder. Or how can I work for justice in the world without my anger, if I don't have that energy? I'm afraid I'd lose my motivation if I didn't have that anger, people will say. Aristotle once said, anybody can become angry, that is easy. But to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power and is not easy. Well, I think we could all agree with that. As I said earlier, we discussed why it's not easy to practice with anger. It's such a powerful emotion, and when our stress hormones are fired up in an angry defensive reaction, they can override our higher functions of good judgment, wisdom, and compassion. But somehow in the West, we do tend to view anger as quite normal and appropriate, as a normal and appropriate response in certain situations, right? As Aristotle said, right time, right place, right timing, right way. We value righteous indignation generally in our society, and we see it as a necessary energy to combat wrongdoing. But righteous indignation is all too often self-righteous, contaminated by ego attachment of various kinds. Recently I spoke to a woman who was reflecting on her own experience of righteous anger. Oh, I guess I'm not speaking loud enough. He turned it off. It is better without it. She was serving on the board of a nonprofit organization, and and I'm changing some details here for privacy. And the director of the organization was retiring after many years of fine service. And this woman came up with an idea of a gift for the departing person, a wonderful gift, which was rather expensive, to the hundreds of dollars. And her idea was voted down or rejected by the others on the board. And she was really, really angry. And she had a very strong reaction, and she wasn't like, what's going on here? So I asked her to go a little deeper and see if she could get a sense of what lay beneath that sense of outrage. And very quickly she realized, she said, well, they weren't appreciating the hard work of the directors. They weren't appreciative enough. And then she said, I often feel unappreciated. That's my kind of default mode. And so she was extending that feeling to the director, or projecting it, we could say. And then I asked her what gift giving meant to her. And she said, I just love to find just the right gift for a particular occasion, a particular person. And it doesn't have to be expensive. It could be the simplest little thing that I put together. But I just take great joy in that. And I asked her, well, then it must have felt like this giving heart of yours was not being seen. And tears came for her to realize that. How easily our personal hurts and habit patterns can become entangled with our moral judgments and externalized. And we've probably all done it. In interpersonal situations, as we've probably experienced, when you're the recipient of someone else's righteous anger, you know how that blocks open-hearted connection. You know, our defenses go up, right? When we're seen as the one in the wrong, or the offender. Well, the same thing is true of righteous anger in social, political, and international spheres. And we can easily see that in the news. It's the self, that self-identification of self-righteousness, that's the problem, and that divides self from others, us from them, right? The goodies and the baddies. I read an article by John McCransky, who's an American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, who holds social justice workshops to support people doing that work with practices from the Buddhist tradition. And his article was called, Can Anger Ever Be a Good Thing? And he asks, can there be something like what we call anger that is not the expression of a defensive self-protectiveness? Again, this is him. He says, I would say yes, absolutely. Authentic compassion may take confrontational forms that can seem like anger but are not. Can you imagine a very clear energy based in deep caring and compassion that could manifest at times in a forceful, even fierce way, but is completely free from hatred? To me, that would no longer be what we call anger. But in English, we don't have a word for that kind of fierceness. But the Dalai Lama tells us that in Tibetan, there is such a distinction. There are two very closely related terms in Tibetan. Shedang is anger arising from hatred and aversion. And Khongdro is a fierce energy that arises out of compassion. It may be expressed in forceful, emphatic language or action, but it is free of that personal attack element. Makransky calls this energy wrathful compassion. But to me, that's a little bit too much of an oxymoron. I kind of prefer maybe fierce compassion. The classic example, of course, is forcefully intervening when a child is about to run out into traffic, right? But there's the difference between a forceful shout or action and "you idiot," et cetera, et cetera. "How could you do such a stupid thing?" Right? There's a big difference in what's communicated, or the when it's care. The child is not shamed. That's a really important difference. Imagine if our political leaders and dissenters, you know, on the far left and the far right, were able to use this powerful energy skillfully. In his article, Makransky says, "When Martin Luther King demonstrated against social institutions of racism and economic inequality, his opponents used attack dogs and whips on him and his followers. Yet King repeatedly taught that unconditional love is the key to foundational social change. He taught that we must confront social structures of racism on behalf of everyone, including those supporting such structures, not just the oppressed, but on behalf of the oppressors as well. It was never only, this is the essential difference between ordinary anger and fierce compassion. It's not us versus them, it's a better world for us and them. Ordinary anger is motivated by fear and aversion. Fierce compassion is motivated by love that has the courage to confront people for their sake and ours. Anger seeks to protect the self or one's own self-righteousness, one's own values, property, etc. Fierce compassion seeks to protect all beings by challenging what harms them. Our first week, our opening week, I referred to a book by the grandson of the great nonviolent activist and leader Mohandas Gandhi. The grandson's name is Arun Gandhi, and he recently published a book called The Gift of Anger and Other Lessons from My Grandfather. In an interview with Tricycle Magazine, Arun Gandhi tells this story that I actually wanted to play for you so that you could hear it in his voice, but I just don't think my laptop has quite the volume, and his voice is a bit soft, so I'm going to try and paraphrase the story and encourage you, if you'd like, to listen to the podcast. If you Google Tricycle, Arun Gandhi Tricycle Interview, you'll find it easily, and you can listen online. Arun Gandhi was raised as a boy in South Africa, and because he was neither white nor black, but of Indian ethnicity, he received bullying and abuse from both sides as a boy, and he became very angry. So his parents sent him to live with his grandfather in India on his ashram. And so hence the content of the book, what he learned from his grandfather. He later married an Indian woman, but was unable to take her back to South Africa to live. They considered doing that, but he couldn't go. So the story involves Gandhi going to, he's in Mumbai, and he goes to meet a ship, a friend who's arriving from South Africa on a ship. And before he can meet his friend, a white man comes rushing up to him and shakes his hand and greets him and introduces himself. And he doesn't explain why the man recognized him. We'll have to guess about that. And he immediately recognized this man as a very high-ranking politician in the South African apartheid government and a strong defender of apartheid. And his initial action was a very strong upsurge of outrage. You know, this man symbolized the system that he suffered under, that Gandhi suffered under as a young boy, and many others as well. And he felt like throwing him overboard. But he did not. We can speculate that he took a deep breath and chose to extend hospitality to this man. He said, well, I'd like to welcome you to our country, to my country, and I'd like to show you around and be your host. But I want you to know that I'm strongly opposed to apartheid. I suffered under it greatly as a young boy. And so he and his wife hosted this politician and his wife for 4 or 5 days, took them around to see all the sites, had dinner with them, and had repeated conversations about South Africa and apartheid. They debated, but as soon as things would get a little overheated, he would back off and just subtly change the subject. And then it would come around again. By the end of the 4 or 5 days, it was time to say goodbye. Both the politician and his wife wept as they thanked the other couple for their kindness and hospitality. And the politician said, "You have turned me around. You have turned, I feel entirely different about apartheid. And I will go home and change my ways." So Gandhi was skeptical. He said, "Well, those people, they say one thing outside the country, but when they're back inside the country, they toe the line." But the politician actually went back and became a strong advocate against apartheid, lost his seat in the legislative parliament or whatever it was. It was expelled from his party and stayed steady throughout the transition. After hearing this story, the interviewer went back and asked him about those dinnertime conversations when he kind of backed off the debate. And she said, "Well, you know, in our culture these days, it's a very standard thing that you call out somebody who has an opinion you disagree with, or or they're being politically incorrect. You're quick on the draw and you call them out. And you didn't do that." And he said, "No. It was important in that case." To use kindness and patience. He didn't say patience. I'm adding that because that's what I feel he did. He said, "It has become the norm in our present-day culture to do that in such an aggressive way, that calling out, you know, that it's counterproductive, that people only become more defensive. And it never opens hearts or changes minds. So is it possible to, as the Quakers say, to speak truth to power in a non-aggressive way in the current climate of fear-mongering and anger incitement from both the right and the left? Arun Gandhi suggests that to sustain the materialistic values and lifestyle of our times, we have had to create a culture of violence. Now that's not new, but maybe it's always been true that when there's power and wealth at stake, violence is necessary to defend it. It's expressed in language, politics, sports, and relationships. He claims that materialism and morality have an inverse relationship. When profit is paramount, people are expendable. And when the security of what we believe is ours is threatened, we strike back. The purpose of terrorism, right, is to instill fear in those that are perceived as enemies, as a threat to our values and security. The mind of terrorism is blind to the reality that the security of one nation utterly depends on the security of all, and vice versa. And as we know, violence and terror just fuel more violence and terror. How do we create peace? How do we dismantle the culture of violence, which depends on fear? Well, we need to nurture a culture of nonviolence and love and respect. Gandhi the Elder, the grandfather, famously said, "We have to be the change we wish to see in the world." You've probably heard that phrase. And the Buddha famously said, "Hatred never ceases by hatred. By love alone it is healed." So how do we engage at the social and political level, transforming the energy of anger into wisdom, compassion, and skillful means? Well, really, the same way we work with our own personal and interpersonal aversive reactions. It's really not different. First, you pay attention to your direct experience of body, mind, and heart. How does this arising of anger feel in the body? What thoughts accompany it? What is the tender place of fear and vulnerability beneath the anger? How is your view colored by your personal history? What is it you deeply care about? Remember we said last week, you don't get angry about things that you don't care about, right? You get angry at what, because you do care. So you have to get underneath to feel, what is that? What is it I really care about? How do I express that? And then you notice the self-focused habit. I'll give you a moment. There it goes. Oh.
I forgot to turn it off, sorry.
Happens to the best of us. we notice those self-focused habit patterns that we talked about last week that kick in without, without noticing. So we notice black and white thinking. We notice generalizing, exaggerating. We notice our internal assumptions and rules. Watch out for the word should, right? We notice externalizing, blaming the other, not taking responsibility for our own reactions. All those habit patterns obscure our view and distort our motivations, our speech, and our actions. For our work for peace and justice and well-being in the world to be effective and to be sustainable, we need to see with our Dharma eye and listen with the ears of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who hears the cries of the world. That's what the name means, Kuan Yin or Kuan Zeon, hearing the cries of the world, and then respond. Have you seen the images of thousand-armed Kuan Yin? Right? And each hand has an eye, and each hand has a different tool to respond to different needs. We have to also have a very long, wide, deep view that sees into the causes and conditions of human suffering. All our ancient twisted karma, as are the verse we chant. There's a verse many of you know, that we chant before we chant the Bodhisattva precepts, the guidelines for right conduct. All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born from body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And sometimes I like to chant it all our ancient twisted karma of humanity, because we share it. The roots go back and back and back until it's all connected in our human condition. So in looking as clearly as we can at our experience of anger and letting go of the places where we're snagged by self-clinging, we purify karma and free ourselves to respond with this hand to this person and this hand to that person appropriately. This long, wide, deep view supports the practices of patience and forgiveness, which are both really crucial in practicing with anger. Our own anger, and then particularly with anger that's directed towards us. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. What's it like to be on the receiving end of anger? Nobody likes it, right? Yeah. So patience and forgiveness we'll talk about next week. But now, I'd like you to have a chance to talk with each other a little bit about righteous anger. So I'll pause.